The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer and the New York Times. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Well, reports continue to point to better days ahead when it comes to the pandemic and its impact on our lives and our travel plans. And as we talk about that, our first couple of articles on today's Armchair Traveler are going to provide a snapshot of what we can expect when it comes to traveling in the coming year, 2022, and maybe beyond. Nikki Eckstein is with Bloomberg News, and she recently checked in with travel industry icon Expedia and found that Expedia's CEO predicts the busiest travel season ever. Now, her story was published in the February 19th, 2022 issue of the News and Observer, so let's see what Nikki learned. Expedia Chief Executive Officer Peter Kern believes that 2023 will be the year that we stop predicting a travel recovery and actually start enjoying it. But before then, he forecasts something bolder. Summer 2022 will be the busiest travel season ever, he said, speaking over Zoom from his home in Wyoming. We've been talking about pent-up demand for a long time, but until now there have been too many restrictions in place for people to do too much with it, he explained. With Europe expected to relax restrictions, mask mandates falling even in liberal U.S. states, and borders reopening in parts of the world, such as Australia, that had not yet welcomed back international tourism, many pandemic-era travel barriers will start to recede. It's not just the ease of travel that will pretend it's come back. It's the combination of high volumes and high prices. Airlines are expecting to be back to historic levels by August, Kern said, and yes, prices will be high, but at this point, I think people are willing to pay whatever it takes to get away and to go to a place they want to go. After all, he explains, a part of pent-up demand is pent-up savings. People tired of spending on material home goods are ready to shell out for experiences, be it in cash or loyalty points that have been gathering dust since 2020. As for where they might be going, Kern is looking at cities. People are tired of going to national parks. They want to go to New York and go to a Broadway show, he said, adding that cities in Europe with loads of cultural attractions and dining options, think Florence, Paris, London, will also sustain enormous demand. Kern isn't the only one who sees a big summer season. On February 9th, the World Travel and Tourism Council, also known as WTC, updated its economic modeling with predictions that U.S. travel and tourism would exceed pre-pandemic levels by 6.2%, accounting for almost $2 trillion in U.S. gross domestic product. In Europe, the Council's data shows that summer 2022 bookings have already surpassed 2021 levels by at least 80%. For parts of the world where movement was more limited in 2021, travelers are especially keen to make up for lost time. According to Expedia data, nearly a third of Australians have at least three trips planned for 2022. Kern says that summer is traditionally the busiest and most profitable season for Expedia, as well as for the border travel industry by a meaningful margin. And while he's made similar claims in previous pandemic cycles, there are reasons to believe 2022 will be different. You could go through that whole thesis about how people are working from anywhere and untethering from the traditional calendar, Kern said, taking direct aim at his rival, Airbnb's Brian Chesky. But in the summertime, kids are out of school and the weather is good, so everybody goes everywhere. Summer will always be summer. Kern is quick to caution that this doesn't mean the travel industry will recover evenly. The cruise business, for instance, will take longer to recover than hotels or airlines simply because of how long it has shouldered heavy restrictions from the Centers for Disease Control. Regionally speaking, Asia and Latin America are unlikely to see strong bounce backs in 2022 because of both tighter lockdowns and higher ongoing caseloads, he says. Business travel is still lagging significantly. So there you have a snapshot of what the travel picture looks like from an expert from Expedia. And earlier this year, we heard from New York Times travel editor Amy Bershop. She invited readers to reveal that what their travel plans might be for the coming year, and she published some of their responses in a weekly travel dispatch letter. And this one was published in February 26, 2022 edition of the New York Times. So here we go. It starts, "Dear Travel Fan, last week I asked how you were thinking about travel in 2022. Were you, as many experts predicted, planning to go big this year to make up for the journeys not taken during the pandemic? We heard from more than 700 readers, and here's a sampling of the responses," and she notes some answers have been lightly edited for length and clarity. She begins with, "Some people are going big. The travel industry has quite a bit of my money, with canceled trips in 2020 and 2021 moved to 2022 and 2023. On the schedule is a safari in Botswana, a hiking trip to Tuscany and Umbria, a Christmas market trip to Germany and Austria, a barge cruise down the Nile, and a trip to Morocco." Boy, this person's got a travel budget, don't they? "And we're going to make up for lost travel time and being isolated for too long. I'm even looking forward to being in an airport," writes Beatrice Baldwin of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Next letter, "Taking 5 trips to make up for lost time. I'm just returning from 8 days in Iceland. I'm also going to Borneo and Pantanal in Brazil, to Portugal, and on a cruise to West Africa," writes Lois Krauss of Arizona. "Next, as a beleaguered nurse, I am going big. I am quitting my job March 1st and taking a year-long sabbatical to southern Albania. I have lost my center during the pandemic. I hope to take monthly trips in places I wanted to see, Portugal, Italy, Cyprus, Spain, Greece, Budapest, Prague, and Belgium, with more to be added. I want to see who I am when I leave all my structure behind," writes Tammy Baltimore, Louisville, Kentucky. And I question Tammy being in Albania, given what's going on with the Ukrainian crisis, so that might be interesting to see if there's a follow-up from her. Next, "Some people are going small across the pond to New Zealand's South Island, which will travel by bicycle through the vineyards and then by motorbike through the mountains and lakes," writes Karen Price of Australia. And then some people are simply hanging back. "We are not booking international travel yet. There's still too much uncertainty around restrictions and what may happen with another mutation of the coronavirus. So for now, we're beginning to travel via auto. We're considering Scotland in September," writes Walt Hubis of Westminster, Colorado. "No big trips this year," begins our next note. "I find myself more low-key, less about the big splash and hordes of humans, and more about serenity, friends, and nature. Less about destroying the planet and more about appreciating its beauty and worth," writes Karen O'Flynn of Canton, Connecticut. And then some people are just constantly calculating in this particular note. "Now we need to consider the vaccination rates and virus case counts in a particular area before we decide to plan a vacation. How crowded would an area be? Is there good medical care nearby if needed? I wonder how long this will be the case, or will this take forever?" writes Anita LaFon-Koronsky of Livingston, New Jersey. Then we have some who just stay flexible and cautious. "The biggest thing I'm going to do differently this trip is making sure my airfare is refundable and hotel reservations can be canceled at the last minute." And this one is from Rebecca here in Raleigh, North Carolina. And then we go on to, "I'm nervous about handing over hundreds of dollars to schedule trips when things seem less certain, because some companies make it as difficult as possible to get your money back. I'm being pickier about who I trust with my money when I plan to travel now," writes Ashley of Sacramento, California. And then there's, "And asking why not now? We are in our 70s. We have lost time to enjoy the things that give us the greatest pleasures, our grandchildren and travel. As a result, we are going to London with our son, daughter-in-law, and 2 grandsons. We want to make lasting memories. If not now, when?" writes Cynthia Feldman of Wellington, Florida. So there you go. And Amy Bershop, who is the New York Times travel editor, closes with, "Perhaps you see yourself in one or more of the responses," which we just read. And she says, "I certainly did, and maybe you did too." Okay. Well, as we become more willing to travel, the next step is probably asking ourselves, where do we go? Well, is one possibility that seems to be somewhat universally popular is traveling to a state or national park, even though Expedia says that's not necessarily going to be on the number one list this year. Obviously, there are many choices to consider when it comes to parks, but one of the oldest and most popular, and I think has appeared in the news quite a bit in recent months, is Yellowstone. Recently, David Kendi, in a special to the Washington Post, reported on how Buffalo Bill and a Civil War general saved Yellowstone, which is kind of a good backstory if you're traveling in that area. Now, the story appeared in the March 7, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer, so let's see what Dave learned in his special report. In 1883, the public was transfixed by Yellowstone National Park, and not in a good way. This 2-million-acre national treasure, mostly in Wyoming, but with some land in Montana and Idaho, was being despoiled by commercial interest through the slaughter of wild animals, unrestricted logging, and vandalism of hot springs. On February 25th, a letter published in the New York Sun heightened the sense of crisis. The author warned of mammoth mistakes at Yellowstone, which marks its 150th anniversary this month, and urged Congress to prevent the killing of the once plentiful buffalo, specifically American bison, the last of which were now being hunted to extinction at the park. Their slaughter has been criminally large and useless, he wrote. The letter was signed by William Cody, better known as Buffalo Bill. Ironically, he had earned that nickname 15 years earlier for killing 4,000 buffalo as a contract supplier of meat to the railroads as they laid down track across the West. Of the estimated 30 million bison that roamed the Great Plains in the 1850s, only a few thousand remained in isolated pockets in 1883. Cody described in detail the destruction taking place at America's first, indeed the world's first, national park. He wrote that the plan to supply park hotels with wild game by hunters was being thoughtlessly carried out, and that Native Americans never killed buffalo and elk where there because they looked upon the majestic scenery and geothermal marvels at Yellowstone with a spiritual awe. Cody had not actually been to the park in at least 10 years and really didn't know what was going on there at the time. So why did he write the letter? Most likely as a favor to an old Army buddy, Lieutenant General Philip Sheridan, commander of the Cavalry Corps in the Civil War and the architect of the brutal Indian Wars on the Great Plains, had long advocated for Yellowstone to be protected. Cody, who served as chief of scouts for the U.S. Cavalry under Sheridan in 1869, would become the front man for the commanding general of the Army in shaping public opinion to save the park. Established through a law signed by President Ulysses Grant on March 1, 1872, Yellowstone National Park was seen as a way to preserve and showcase one of America's great natural beauties. The stunning scenes of geysers and grizzlies, waterfalls and wildlife, forest and flora captured the attention and imagination of newspaper and magazine readers by the thousands, tempting a tidal wave of tourists from the east to this isolated expanse. The trouble was, Congress had done little to fund the new idea of a national park. A succession of superintendents had little staff and virtually no money for management and supervision of this large swath of wilderness. Instead, commercial enterprises, some illegal, began building hotels, restaurants, and other venues while prospectors and loggers pillaged the park almost at will. Many visitors treated the hot springs as their own personal hot tubs, causing irreparable damage. Sheridan made two early trips to Yellowstone, first on an inspection tour in 1877 with General William Tecumseh Sherman, and again in 1881. After the second visit, Sheridan wrote a report urging more funding than the $15,000 the government was spending there each year. Sheridan's report was largely ignored. In 1883, the Department of the Interior was about to grant permission to a private contractor to develop more than 4,000 acres of parkland for commercial use. The Yellowstone National Park Improvement Company would have private control of certain areas and planned to build a railroad into the park. In fact, the firm had already produced 1.6 million board feet of lumber from pristine forest in the park to build a 250-room hotel at Mammoth Hot Springs in Yellowstone. Many, Sheridan included, feared this would lead to the devastation of a natural wonder, much like what happened at Niagara Falls, which was converted into a commercialized tourist trap. After years of speaking about protecting Yellowstone, Fight and Phil decided it was time for action. He enlisted the aid of numerous supporters, including Cody, who headed the popular Buffalo Bill's Wild West, a touring show with a heavily romanticized view of life on the Great Plains. For his counteroffensive, Sheridan also decided to pull out the big gun, President Chester Arthur. Sheridan invited Arthur, an avid angler, to visit Yellowstone in the summer of 1883 as part of a fact-finding and fishing trip, also joining what would become known as the President Arthur Expedition with Secretary of War Robert Lincoln, the son of Abraham Lincoln, and Senator George Graham Vest of Missouri. Sheridan planned the whole excursion to Wyoming, nearly 2,000 miles from Washington, D.C. The entourage arrived at Yellowstone on horseback in August, spending a week touring the park and wetting their lines in trout ponds along the way. No reporters were invited on the expedition. Instead, Sheridan and one of his adjutants wrote dispatches for Arthur's approval, which were then taken on horseback by military couriers to the nearest telegraph station. Newspapers around the country closely followed the trip. The Yellowstone sojourn was a huge public relations victory for Sheridan and other proponents of protecting the park, including Vest. The senator from Missouri would continue to prod Congress to enact legislation to safeguard the park. Vest was able to pass a resolution that required Senate oversight of all private contracts, effectively ending privatization within the park. The Yellowstone National Park Improvement Company went bankrupt and no railroad was built. The battle may have been won, but the war was not over. Sheridan and Vest would continue to push Congress to adequately fund management of Yellowstone. Each year brought a new struggle to appropriate money. In the meantime, there was almost no enforcement of the laws protecting the 2.2 million acre site. The situation came to a head in 1886, when Congress allotted no funding at all for the national park. But Vest's 1883 resolution included a key provision for protecting Yellowstone, allowing the Secretary of the Interior to request assistance from the Secretary of War. After that appeal was made, Sheridan, the top general in the Army at the time, ordered the cavalry to the rescue. On August 17, 1886, Troop M of the 1st Cavalry Regiment rode into Yellowstone and began to enforce park regulations and arrest lawbreakers. The soldiers put an end to illegal hunting, mining, deforestation, and vandalism at the park. Cavalry unit also built some of the early infrastructure, including roads and trails. The buffalo mentioned in Cody's letter would also finally get protection. Today, nearly 5,000 or 5,500 bison remain in Yellowstone, with a total population of around 31,000 in North America. Troop M would remain at Yellowstone for another 32 years before it rejoined the 1st Cavalry Regiment in 1918. Its official duties of park protection had ended years earlier when the National Park Service was established. Sheridan was appointed General of the Army, the equivalent of five-star general by President Grover Cleveland, shortly before his death at 57 in 1888. Mount Sheridan in Yellowstone is named in his honor. Wow, quite a backstory there for Yellowstone, our first national park, huh? Well, our next couple of articles are going to take us away from the parks and take us abroad, where we're going to explore some new discoveries that have taken place in England. Exceptional Roman ruins discovered in England include road, coins, and makeup. Originally written for the Washington Post by Adela Suleiman, it also appeared in the January 12, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer. A vast ancient Roman trading settlement has been unearthed in England during routine digging work for a new high-speed train track. The rare finds, announced Tuesday, January 11, 2022, include more than 300 coins, jewelry, and a giant Roman road, with the area being described as a significant archaeological site by HS2 Limited, the publicly funded government company developing HS2, a national high-speed railway project. Glass vessels, highly decorative pottery, and even evidence of makeup were uncovered during a potentially well-heeled ancient population. For the last 12 months, or past 12 months, I should say, some 80 archaeologists from MOLA, M-O-L-A, Headland Infrastructure, that's a consortium of British archaeological companies working on the rail project, have been excavating the Iron Age village that developed into a wealthy Roman trading town. The site, which was uncovered near a small village in South North Hampshire, northwest of London, has been dubbed Black Grounds after the deep black-colored soil found there. This is certainly one of the most impressive sites MOLA Headland Infrastructure has discovered, James West, MOLA site manager, said in a statement. Uncovering such a well-preserved and large Roman road, as well as so many high-quality finds, has been extraordinary and tells us so much about the people who lived here. The presence of the Roman settlement had been known about in the area since the 18th century, according to the HS2 team, but the scale and quality of the discoveries on site have surpassed expectations. Archaeologists say the original use of the Black Ground site may have begun in the Iron Age when it was a village formed of over 30 rudimentary dwellings. Evidence from the recent dig suggests the settlement expanded over time and became more prosperous during the Roman period, with new stone buildings and roads emerging. Experts say inhabitants may have taken on Roman customs, products, and building techniques and adapted to new ways of life. At its peak during the Roman age, Black Grounds would have been a bustling and busy area, shown through the evidence of workshops, kilns, and several beautifully preserved wells, the team said, adding that there is evidence of possible bread-making or foundries for metalwork. The site really does have the potential to transform our understanding of the Roman landscape in the region and beyond, West added. The 10-meter-wide, or about 33 feet, Roman road, which is an exceptional in its size, indicates that the settlement would have been busy with the traffic of carts loading and unloading goods, the experts say. The wealth of the settlement is likely to have been based on trade, both from the nearby River Cherwell and via the Roman road. The discovery of more than 300 Roman coins is also an indication of a significant volume of commerce passing through the area, the team added. The archaeological gem has been unearthed while work is underway on the HS2 train line project, which eventually aims to connect major English cities such as Birmingham and Leeds with London to become the backbone of Britain's transport network. The infrastructure project has been championed by successive British governments, but has faced criticism for delays and overspending. The artifacts are now being cleaned and analyzed by specialists, and the details of the buildings and layout of the settlement will be carefully mapped. Black Grounds is one of the over 100 archaeological sites that HS2 has examined since 2018 between London and Birmingham, and it provides a further insight into Britain's rich Roman history. The finds have not stopped the massive train project in its tracks yet, according to HS2, because advanced planning work and surveys help to ensure the plotted routes avoid disrupting the historic sites. As we near the end of our archaeological field work, we have made some unprecedented discoveries, which we will continue to share with communities, Mike Court, lead archaeologist for HS2 Limited, said in the most recent statement. So, something fun to look forward to, some exceptional Roman ruins if you're planning to head to England anytime soon. And from South North Hampshire, Hamptonshire, I should say, we head now to a much more familiar tourist site in England, at least one that's made the news probably more, Stonehenge. Associated Press writer Jill Lawless explores new developments involving this well-known tourist attraction. Now, her story, Stonehenge Through the Ages, Exhibit Brings Builders to Life, was published in the February 20th, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer. So let's see what's new at Stonehenge. For a monument that's been drawing crowds for thousands of years, Stonehenge still holds many secrets. The stone circle, whose giant pillars each took 1,000 people to move, was erected between 5,000 and 3,500 years ago on a windswept plain in southwest England. Its purpose is still debated. Was it a solar calculator, a cemetery, a shrine? A new exhibition at the British Museum in London unravels some of the mystery. Stonehenge was at times all those things, but the exhibition's bigger goal is bringing to life the sun-worshipping and surprisingly sophisticated people who built it. "We all feel we know Stonehenge," lead curator Neil Wilkins said on Tuesday. "We drive past it on A303, that's the highway, and we visit as schoolchildren or bring our kids to see it. But often we don't know much or feel like we don't know much about the world, the people who built the monument, and who came to worship at the monument." The World of Stonehenge exhibition assembles more than 430 objects from across Europe to explore the monument's creators and their world. It was a time of radical change that saw technological advances, large-scale migration, and social transformation. The objects explore successive groups of people who lived in the area, 80 miles southwest of modern-day London. The semi-nomadic Neolithic farmers who built the first phase of Stonehenge, with stones hauled 150 miles from Wales, were followed by Bronze Age farmers, traders, and warriors who were deeply intertwined with continental Europe. The evolving uses of Stonehenge reflect the changing society. At first, it was a cemetery where the cremated remains of 150 to 200 men, women, and children, a seeming cross-section of society, were interred. People often ask, is it like the pyramids? But there's no pharaoh in the middle of this monument, said Wilkin. It's more of a communal enterprise. Later, the original blue stones were encircled in a ring of 13-foot standing stones capped with lintels, much of which still stands. Wilkin said the monument became a site for ancestral veneration and for ceremonies that drew visitors from far afield. Its fame is reflected playfully in the very first object displayed in the show, an ancient cup whose shape mimics that of Stonehenge. It's almost like a prehistoric souvenir, said project curator Jennifer Wexler. There are many other arresting images in the exhibition, from a wall covered in scores of Neolithic stone axes to finely wrought gold hats and jewelry that took medieval but are many centuries older. While Stonehenge was not the only circular henge monument built in the ancient Britain, the exhibition includes Seahenge, a circle of oak posts made 4,000 years ago and near miraculously uncovered by the waves on an English beach in 1998. Like Stonehenge, it's believed to have been aligned with the sun, which was central to the lives and beliefs of these ancient societies. Stonehenge is aligned with sunrise and sunset, respectively, at the summer and winter solstices, the key dates in the calendar for ancient farmers. The exhibition's star item is the 3,600-year-old Nebra Sky Disc, a bronze disc inlaid with gold symbols representing the sun, moon, and stars, believed to be the oldest surviving map of the cosmos. The disc was found in 1999 in eastern Germany, but the gold comes from Cornwall in southwest England, evidence that ancient Britons were more connected than we might think. People were inquisitive and adventurous despite having relatively short lives compared to us, Wilkin said. There's a really large amount of mobility and migration at this time. That mobility eventually swept away the Stone Age culture that built Stonehenge as a metalworking. Immigrants from Europe brought social, technological, and demographic transformation. So next time you head to England, think about Stonehenge as part of your itinerary. And finally, as we kind of wrap up today's journey, we're going to end with a brief look at North Carolina's landmark, considered among the nation's most beautiful. We're speaking, of course, of Biltmore. In this review by Simone Jasper of the Charlotte Observer, published February 20, 2022, in the online edition of the News and Observer, a sister publication. North Carolina is home to one of the most beautiful U.S. landmarks, so grab your camera, a new report finds. The Biltmore Estate in Asheville ranks number 2 on a nationwide list of the spots that are most attractive to tourists, according to results published. And that was published within the last couple of months, to say. To create the list, the travel blog Parks Sleep Fly said it examines reviews that visitors left on the website TripAdvisor. Analysts said they focused on famous landmarks to see how many people reviewed them, using the words beautiful, pretty, picturesque, and stunning. And certainly all those apply, don't they? The only site listed higher than the Biltmore Estate was the Golden Gate Bridge in California, results show. But more than 3,000 reviews that praised its appearance, the Asheville landmark still earned the top honor. And that, my friends, brings us an end to today's journey on Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be joining us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and reminding you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.